welcome to the podcast of The Calling, and this is Marek Zabriskie. We're delighted to have you with us here today, and especially our guest, Bill Harrison, the former CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, the world's largest bank, and a member of Christ Church Greenwich, and we're really honored to have you with us today, Bill. And Andrew Boyer, my co-pilot here, who always asks insightful questions. Andrew, it's great to be doing this
with you. Oh, good to be here, too. We had some technical difficulty, but now we're, you know, we have a clean runway, so let's go.
We're up and flying. Great. Well, Bill, you grew up in Rocky Mount, North Carolina. I've heard great things about that town. And it's always interesting to know, what were people thinking back when they were in high school who've gone on to achieve such success? When you were 16, 17, 18, what were you thinking back then?
I was thinking about being a good basketball player, and that was about it. But when you look back on my experience in Rocky Mount, I think these small towns, it was an eastern North Carolina town, 30,000 people. I grew up with great parents, great family, teachers, coaches, friends. Everybody gets to know each other. And there's something about a small town that gives you a foundation to sort of discover who you are, but get comfortable in your own skin. And that helped me a lot. And came time for me to probably take the next step. I went off to prep school at Virginia Episcopal School for 2 years. And that's when I started really discovering something more than basketball, and you know, about maybe some leadership qualities, management qualities I might have had. And that was the beginning of, I'd say, a little bit of maturing, developing, and blossoming as a kid.
Our daughter went to Episcopal High and loved it. Did the chapel experience or the Episcopal ethos shape you there?
Well, you went to chapel every day, I was just part of part of the deal, and I liked it, and it was good. It didn't really change my life because I'd grown up in Episcopalian and going to church every Sunday, so it was just sort of a continuation of that.
Right, and then you went on to the University of North Carolina and played basketball under Dean Smith. Was there one particular experience or lesson you walked away from that kind of guided you moving forward?
Well, Dean Smith, as we know, is one of the great basketball coaches of our era. And when I started, it was his second year there. He was a young coach. He recruited me. I was a good high school player. I didn't turn out to be a good college player. But he treated me with such respect. He ran the program with such discipline. He was just a marvelous man from an ethics and morality perspective, from an execution perspective, and you just learn a lot from being around somebody like that in practice every day. And one of the takeaways that he always had as a motto was play hard, play smart, and play together. And you can use that anywhere. You can use that in managing a team. I use that at J.P. Morgan Chase, and I use that with my family. So it's just you learn things like that from great people, and he was a great man.
And how about your parents? I mean, I always, when I see someone who I just admire a great deal in character, I always think they must have wonderful parents. How did they shape your success and your outlook in life?
They were critical. I look back on how lucky I was to have parents like them, and they did a lot of things, most everything right, from looking back on it from my perspective. I had a very tough mother who I was very close to later on in life. She was pretty tough on me when I was in high school because I wasn't a great student. And my dad was sort of an entrepreneur guy, loved people. He was out in the community. He was very involved in politics. So the two of them together were a wonderful team. And I learned a lot from both of them. I think I have some qualities of both of them. And I was just fortunate to have had great parents, and I was very close to them. They lived to a pretty late age, so I was close to them for many, many years, and it was a wonderful thing.
You know, you say you weren't a great student, and it's funny because you hear that a lot of really successful people, and they're like, I just didn't, and I always wonder about that because you're obviously very bright, and you're obviously a very hard worker. You wouldn't have done what you did. So what was it that just led you to not be a great student? You didn't you weren't fired up about it? Or
that's a good question. My two daughters always heard me say I wasn't a great student. They didn't totally believe it. And I was looking through my files about 10 years ago, and I found a report from my sophomore year at Carolina. And my daughter and I showed it to my daughters because it proved my point. And they said, Dad, I can't believe you. He said, you knew, you were a moron. You didn't know anything. And I said, look, I told you I wasn't a good student. And I don't know why I wasn't. I mean, I wasn't because I didn't work hard. I just didn't always connect with it, didn't get motivated by it so much. So when I went to work, when I went to New York and started at Chemical Bank, I thought it was going to be a really tough journey. I used to sit in class my senior year at Chapel Hill, and by then you only went to like two classes every other day or something. And it were 50-minute classes, and I would sit there and say, oh, my gosh, this is a long, long time. Next year, I've got to get a real job. I'm going to be working 8 hours a day. And I wasn't excited about that at all. So when I got to New York and went to work for Chemical Bank, it was like, wow, I love going to work every day. I love the people. I'm learning, and I'm feeling like I'm helping the company do their jobs. So that, and that just kept growing. So I'd say, you know, I would rate much higher on EQ than IQ. And I think EQ is underrated. People talk about it a lot, but, you know, EQ relates a lot to leadership. And, you know, if you don't have that, you're probably not going to be able to maximize your talents as well.
So you went to New York, as I recall, thinking you'd go for 2 years and then come back to North Carolina, right? What happened to keep you up there and you never really left the North?
Well, I went up there. I had two choices, stay in North Carolina, go to work for what is now the Bank of America. They offered me a great position in Chapel Hill where I went to school. It was in my comfort zone. I loved it. And then I interviewed at some New York banks, Chemical Bank. They offered me a job. So I had a choice. And I use this example to people as you need to get out of your comfort zone. And somehow I decided that it would be better for me to go to New York, but I wasn't willing to commit a long time. Yes, 2 years was sort of my goal. I thought that was pretty aggressive. I got out, I went up there, and lo and behold, I love the city. I love the people. I love the job. As I said, I love learning every day. And so it became you know, the next big chapter in my life. And instead of spending 2 years, basically I spent 40 years at the bank and then retired.
Well, looking back, what do you think are some of the key accomplishments that you're most proud of achieving?
Well, the most challenging one, and I think the one that I feel most proud of, is that we began the merger process between two of the five New York banks, Manufacturers, Hanover, and Chemical Bank. In 1991, we did the first big merger. And it was a sort of a merger of necessity. It wasn't a great grand strategic vision. Turns out it was the beginning of a strategic vision that says size and scale and leadership positions and a lot of banking activities is going to be the winning model. And that evolved by the end of the 90s. Into us acquiring J.P. Morgan and then acquiring Bank One in 2004. So those were the foundation pieces that were put in place. I was very much a part of it to allow the new management team, Jamie Dimon, to come in and take it to the next level of now being the best bank in the world. And Jamie and I, when we did that deal, thought this had the potential to be the best bank in the world. We were already pretty good, but we weren't great. We thought we could be great, and Jamie's done a wonderful job of taking it to the next level.
You know, I know Jamie Dimon's name, and to me, I wonder why I know Jamie Dimon's name. I didn't know your name until I researched you and met you, and maybe that's partially because your personality is a little more low-key under the radar than his, but, you know, I wonder whether we should know Jamie Dimon's name. I mean, that somebody that he's so powerful now with J.P. Morgan, and the banking industry is so powerful, and he's always on Congress and always on Capitol Hill. You know, is banking getting, you know, too big? Is it becoming too influential? because we have this sort of scale?
I don't think so, because if you look at the banking system in the United States, we still have 5,000 banks. We have some big banks like J.P. Morgan and B of A and Wells Fargo, but we have a lot of community banks. They went through a crisis in the last 2 or 3 months. I think they'll come out of that and be fine, net-net. So we have a great banking system in this country, and having big banks and small banks, I think, is a very nice combination. I wouldn't want to see the country go to 5 big banks. Some countries have let that happen, allowed that to happen. I think our system is pretty good. And why do I like size and scale? Size and scale, if you manage it right, can create a lot of additional opportunities for your clients that they might not have had from a small bank. But you have to manage it well. And that's why I said early on, scale is really important, but scale by itself, size by itself, is not a good thing. You got to make scale, size come alive by having the right culture. That starts with morality and values and all that stuff. And then you've got to add leadership positions in your products. If you go out and offer a product to somebody, it's got to be really good. So you got to pull all those things off, and you need to be global. And that's what we started doing, and Jamie Dimon has taken it to the next level. And he gets a lot of notoriety, but he gets it because J.P. Morgan has been really successful. They are known now as the most profitable bank in the world, and they're known as one of the best banks in the world. That gives Jamie a great platform to deliver a message, and he's very good at doing that. And I think he speaks out on the right topics. He is more outgoing than I am, more opinionated, but he says the right things, and I'm very happy about that.
When would you know that, like, a bank had become too powerful, like that it had unable to be regulated or whatever else? When would you sort of, would the alarm bells go off in your head where you say, okay, maybe this is too big or too global or what? Like, is there...
I don't know the answer to that, but just take J.P. Morgan. I think if you look at us from a United States perspective, we only have 12% of the total deposits of the banking system. So if you look at big companies, that's not a monopolistic position at all. At some point, yeah, you could say that. My guess is it ever got to be that size, you wouldn't be as efficient, and through technology and other innovations and new business models, you would be diminished in some way. That usually happens to big companies over time. You know, it's very hard to survive as a big company. So the perfect example of that is when we did the Chemical Bank Manufacturers Hanover merger. We were not the best banks. We were the fourth or fifth best banks in New York. J.P. Morgan was by far the best bank, and yet they couldn't get out of their own culture. About this is the way we do things. We're not going to change. We don't like the model you're building. Turns out the model we were building is the winning model. And they didn't see that. And so we ended up buying them in 2000. That should have never happened. They should have been the consolidator of the banking industry. And they lost that opportunity for that reason. So that happens to big companies.
So what lies in the future for banking? What changes should we expect to see moving forward?
Well, I think the short term issue there is getting some new relief or regulation, combination of both, to the community regional banks. Because as I said earlier, I think regional banks, community banks, are really important to the fabric of this country for a whole bunch of reasons, and you want them to be successful. So we need to give them some support. They'll probably change the FDIC insurance on deposits. That's what caused the recent banking crisis. So they'll probably change some of these things, and that's all for the good. And then you'll have a more balanced situation that comes back in. Right now, there's a bias against small banks. If you have a lot of deposits in a small bank, having watched what happened to Silicon Valley Bank and a few others, you're going to say, I don't want to take that risk. I'm going to move my money to J.P. Morgan or a big bank. That's not good. And J.P. Morgan has been the beneficiary of a lot of deal flow, which they really didn't want because they don't want to be the monopolistic player. They want to be good. They want to be big and all that, but they don't want to take over.
What about the future of office culture, working remotely or on location? How do you think that's going to shape out moving forward? Will we have all these big buildings, and New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, or are we going to see more vacancies and trouble, you know, filling them?
Well, I think that question of going back to work is a huge question. I have two young daughters who both work virtually. One works virtually, the other doesn't. My son-in-law works virtually, so I see it. I see their life and whatever, and it's kind of nice. You know, they get to stay home and do whatever. But I will just say I'm a little bit old school in this because that generation of my daughter and son-in-law, they sort of take it as a right to work home. I think what will happen here is that you look at it from two perspectives. And again, I'm old school in this, but I think as a manager leader of any organization, I want people near me in the office so you can build a culture, build ethics and values, learn from each other, share. And that's how I think it really accelerates building an organization. Now, from their perspective, the employee, sure, working from home is nice, but what are you missing out on? You're missing out on mentoring. You're missing out on learning every day. You're missing out on the camaraderie of being around others. I happen to think all of that's very important. It's certainly very creative. So it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Right now, you have a situation where the job demand in the United States is such that they have the younger generation has an advantage. They don't have to go into the office. But I know one of the things that Jamie Dimon just announced recently is that he wants all of his managing directors to go in 5 days a week. Well, what happens then? That means that if you're a direct report to that managing director and you're not going in the office and your other competitors are, you're going to be disadvantaged. But it's going to be your choice to make. Do I want to stay home and maybe not get promoted as fast? And maybe the next time there's a round of layoffs, I get disadvantaged because of that. So we're going to see how all this plays out from a value-added perspective over the next 2 or 3 years.
You've hired a lot of people over your career, I'm sure. What do you look for when you bring someone on board? You talked about emotional intelligence trumping IQ. Is that principally what you look for? Or what kind of questions would you ask someone who you were thinking of bringing onto your team?
Well, I like IQ too, so... But I think trying to look for that combination of somebody who has both is what I look for. Now, different jobs don't require the same kind of leadership skills. You can take different back office operations that don't require that as much, although somebody has to run that and be a leader. So, you know, you need some people coming up through your back office operations who are really good leaders and have great EQ skills and whatever. So I would always wait that anyway. But I think what I look for in an interview is how is that person's confidence? How do they handle themselves? How do they obviously answer the questions? But it's a feeling, and I'm told that most times you have an interview, you have subconsciously made a decision on that person like in a very short period of time. Because you have a first impression. Why is that? I don't know, for a lot of different reasons. So you just try to do the best you can, and you don't always get it right. I've made some great hires, and I made some bad hires. So,
like when you retired, was 17 years ago?
Yeah.
How many employees did you have then?
We had about a little over 100,000.
100,000. Okay. So you're in a position, I would say, of like tremendous power and prestige. And then you retire. And it's funny, we talked to Russell Reynolds on this podcast last year, and you know, he retired, and a year later he was back starting another firm. Like he couldn't leave it. What is that like? I mean, how do you walk away from that much sort of power and prestige, and then how do you think about the next part of your life?
No, that's a great question. I ended up, when I retired, having worked 40 years for basically the same bank. That's a long time. And I was 63 years old when I retired. And I was ready to retire because I have a lot of interest in hobbies. And I'm very happy doing stuff on my own without having a 24/7 job. Now, some people aren't. And it's not a right or wrong. It's just like what makes you satisfied and happy in life, which I'm a great believer of. If you're not happy, you're not going to be much help to anybody. So when the biggest problem I had was that I didn't have a great successor. You would think with all of these mergers we did before Bank One, you'd have a long list of people. But I didn't have a long list of people. So I'm like 61, really worried about this. And so I said, I don't want to work another 5 or 6, 7 years, you know? And so that's why getting the Bank One merger done in 2004 solved two problems. And I remember coming home that night, Jamie and I announced the deal. I came home to Ann. I said, Ann, this is the most satisfying day of my business career. And she said, why is that? I said, well, a couple of things, but two things that are really important for a CEO. Number one, that when you retire, you've got a sustainable competitive platform that can keep going. We've accomplished that with this merger because Bank One had a huge consumer business. And secondly, that you have a great successor. And usually that's the hard one. And I said, both of those were done today. So then I had 3 years that Jamie and I worked together. And the only thing I wanted to make sure of is that the ethical values and how Jamie looked at things in the company were consistent with how we were in. Because I knew he was really good. No question about that. And so he was great on everything. So I was like a really happy camper when I retired, and it's been the same for the last 17 years, but that's just because I was ready, but some people aren't, and it worked for me.
So you keep in close touch, I know, with Jamie Dimon, and I think Ann and you went to China with a J.P. Morgan Chase delegation a couple of years ago. What role do you play now? Are you kind of like Gray Emesis or offering advice, or how does the bank utilize you today?
I'm not really involved at all. And I'd say for about 2 or 3 years after I retired, I had some shelf life value that was useful with clients and people that the bank knew. But it doesn't take long when you're sort of out of step with all that. And I was fine. I was fine with that. So, and what you'll find in most situations when you have a transfer of leadership, the new guy doesn't necessarily want to go back and talk to his successor about everything. He just doesn't. I mean, you heard George Bush say that, you know, George Deber never talks to me. You know, we'd think he'd call me about this. But, you know, you just don't. You know, it's a new world. He's got new data. The older guy doesn't have the same data. So the bottom line is I'm not very involved. I help out. Jamie and I have a great relationship. If I ever call him or need something, he's like terrific. But I do private banking business with him and stuff like that. But not much at all, Merrick.
You know, when I was at business school in like 2002, we had two CEOs come and talk to us, and they focused almost entirely about business ethics. And those two CEOs were the CEO of Enron, and it was the CEO of Tyco.
Wow.
I was sort of like, okay, so business ethics as a focus, you know, it called it all into question. So when you talk about business ethics and like how you knew that those are going to be institutionalized, you know, how do you think about it? And like, how do you know that you're actually getting, you know, it's not window dressing, but it actually runs deep?
Well, I think I'm a great believer that it's not much of a distinction between your personal day-to-day life business, your personal day-to-day life morality and ethics than business ethics. I just don't draw that distinction because, you know, morality and ethics are all about what's right and wrong, what's good or bad. And so, you know, you have a situation with your family, your extended family, the community you live in, which is not business, that you're seeing the same kind of things, maybe not as much of, or maybe a little bit different that you do in the business world. So what do you try to do? Sometimes you can influence it, sometimes you can't, but you always start with a view, this is what I believe in, this is what we ought to do. And so that's what you try to do. And ethics and values and most everything starts from the top and trickles down. So again, back to Jamie Dimon, I knew him pretty well, so I didn't go into this thinking that I had a an issue at all. But I did watch it because it was important to make sure that he was the right guy from that perspective, and he was. And then if you get the right person, then you just try to day-to-day reinforce it. But in a big company, it's just harder because you got a lot of people out there. Nobody's perfect. And by the way, it's not just big business. That happens in a big family. Same kind of issues. You get off track on things.
So when I was in Yale Divinity School in my last year, the CEO of Johnson & Johnson came to speak at the School of Organization and Management. And I went down to hear this lecture. I'm sure I was the only guy from the seminary there. But I'll never forget, he talked about redoing the credo for Johnson & Johnson and sharing that around the globe, where every subsidiary and office of J&J had a chance to help redraft that. And then when they sent their contributions in, the mothership kind of sent back the finished product, and everyone goes, hey, did this kind of resemble what we talked about? But it drove through the message that we take ethics seriously here. And he said, I'll never forget this, he said that ethical corporations are more profitable because they attract a higher caliber of person, and people feel better about working for them because if they have to go on a weekend and miss their child's sporting event because they're designing some breakthrough drug that's going to save lots of lives, they feel like they're doing something good for humanity versus I'm just making widgets that shouldn't be even made in the first place, so that people are more productive. Do you think that's true, that the ethical companies are more profitable and attract a better caliber of person?
Well, I've never seen any data on that, but my gut feel would say yes. And I would say most of the well-run companies that I got exposed to, by and large, had good ethical values. Because most CEOs, and again, I think it starts from the top, most CEOs that I knew represented a very high level of ethics and values compared to other groups in my life that I've been exposed to. And nobody's perfect. They're good people and bad people. But I think people want to work for good people. And I certainly did. I mean, when I look back on who I worked for as I moved up the ladder at J.P. Morgan Chase, there's no question that that was important to me. I looked at the leader I had and what does he represent? I was lucky. I not only got along with all the guys I worked for, but I also really respected them for a lot of things, including ethics and values. You know.
Let me ask you this. You must have had tremendous pressure at times, especially in making these huge mergers come through and the deals. How did you, at the pinnacle of your career, deal with stress and manage that?
Well, I was lucky in that I'm a believer that your DNA is not unimportant, and I had a dad who was never stressed, and he had some reasons from time to time to be stressed, and he was able to manage through all that. He could take a nap anytime, and it turns out that that's sort of true with me, and I know Ann, my wife, would wake up in the middle of the night sometimes worried about something. I never do, and I never did. When I was in the height of some of the challenges when I was a CEO, I slept like a baby because I was able to go to sleep and just not worry about it. And the first thing I'd do when I got in the car to drive to New York the next day, I was reading my iPad. I would always go to the sports section first. I don't care what was going on, and find out whatever. So I don't know. I just sort of put things in perspective. And then I got really focused on what I was supposed to do. But I've never been a person who stresses out much over stuff. I don't think.
I think that's an amazing talent.
I know.
You know, it's
a gift.
It's a gift.
I wish I had.
I wouldn't call it a talent.
No,
it is.
Gift. It's a gift, and it's probably what makes people able to become really, really successful is to be able to compartmentalize and sort of leave that out of their brain and get a good night's sleep. It's incredible.
Yeah, I just found my jaw dropped when you said that.
Yeah, but we looked at each other being like, oh, my God. I wish I had that.
Yeah. And so in my former church, I had a CEO who ran and started a corporation called Airgas. And we were having lunch one day, and I said, Peter, I know what your title is, CEO, but in a sentence or two, could you tell me what that means to you? And he, without hesitation, just said, Chief Environmental Officer. And I said, I get that. Thank you. That was so helpful. But what does that title mean to you?
Well, I would relate it to leadership and what's required of great leaders. And I think the most important thing of a great leader is they've got to have a vision. You know, if you think about it, if you don't have a vision, people aren't going to follow you. People don't follow you, you're not going to be a leader. I mean, it's almost as simple as that. And so any leader has got to have a vision. And I took that a step way down in the company. I said to the 100,000 employees, don't just look at the top people as having to be good leaders and vision and all that stuff. You on the bottom of the company should be leaders. And this is how I define leaders. A leader is someone with a view, tries to influence people to change, make it better. And that's what you all ought to be doing. I try to do that at the top. You ought to be doing that at the bottom. I'm just a great believer in that. So I think having a vision and then pushing that vision down, and how do you do that? Part of the vision is the right strategy, the right culture, and getting the right people and all that stuff. But I think it starts with vision.
You told me a great story once about, I think it was when the J.P. Morgan and Chase merged, and you went around and met with all these key groups. And there was one guy who was kind of like a bomb thrower, taking you on, making comments that were very unproductive, and you kind of singled him out. And he just turned around after that. Could you share that story? Because I was so struck by that.
Yeah, I taught a leadership after the J.P. Morgan Chase merger. I taught a leadership course for 2 days with me and some of my colleagues. And I was the MC the whole time. So it was a great way for me to get connected with 100 people at a time. Next month, another 100, whatever. And so I had 3 or 4 subjects that I would teach during those 2 days. One of them was on feedback. And I'd just given this talk. It was the first day of the class. I'd just given this talk on feedback. And I made the comment, you know, feedback year end is great. We ought to be doing that on a regular basis. But the best feedback is when you see something right there, go up to somebody and constructively say something, because then they'll relate to it. And so I gave it a little speech. And this guy in the back of the room raised his hand and he was doing it all morning and was really pretty obnoxious. And he was a J.P. Morgan guy, and he was pretty senior. He was a very senior guy, actually. And I got irritated with him. So it was 12:30, time to go to lunch, and I'm standing up there, and you have a moment as a leader. You're standing there trying to teach a class, and I said, you know, I'm not being true to myself and what I've been saying for the last 45 minutes unless I say something to this guy. So I stopped the class, and I said, look, I want to let's call him George. I said, George, I want to say something about you. I said, you know, all morning long, you have been an irritant to me, and I'm sure most of your classmates in here have not appreciated sort of your tone and whatever. I don't know quite why you're doing it. You must love this place and want to change it, whatever. But it's not a good way to go about it, and whatever. So I said that in a more constructive way than I just told you, but it was pretty direct. And so the class ended, and I went up to him. I said, George, look, I apologize, but I had to do that, and I hope you're okay with it. He said, I just want to tell you. He said, I so appreciate that. He said, I love this company, and I just get frustrated with some of the things that are going on, and that's why I speak out. And you're the first person, the first leader who's ever told me that, and I get it. And turns out we had a process where at the end of the 2 days, the class would always elect a president. They elected this guy as president. He and I became really close. He would help me on projects. He was 2 or 3 levels down, but you need people to help you do stuff. And he and I became good friends, actually. I mean, not good friends, but good friends. And it was just a story of feedback, and it benefited everybody.
Do you think that'd fly today? Or today, it would seem so risky to try to do, you know?
No, you can.
Environment?
I'm a great believer in, as long as you do it constructively. I did it a little more constructively than I just describe, but no, I think if feedback is done right, you can always do it.
It's a great story.
Bob Buford wrote a book called Halftime, and he said the first half of life is about achieving success, seeing how high you can climb the ladder, reaching for the brass ring. But he said the second half of life is about moving from success to significance. And the way you do that is you become a mentor. So you mentored that gentleman. But you and Ann and you both go into a school down in, I think it's North Palm Beach, a high school in a pretty economically depressed area, and you mentor young people. How has that experience been for you? And I know you've taught them how to shake hands, a firm handshake, and look them in the eye, and how you dress if you're going for an interview, and small things that they may not be getting at home but make a huge difference. How has that experience been?
It's been a really great experience, and the reason I did that is I wanted to try to reach out and help a little bit in my retired life, because my retired life's a pretty easy life, and so you want to do a little bit more than just enjoy yourself all day. So I got involved in this public school. It's 2,500 kids, 9 through 12. We taught 11, a friend and I taught an 11th grade class, and the takeaway, the bottom line takeaway for both of us is that we had the perception that high schools in this country are totally broken, and it's going to be a real challenge. We got in there, we found out the teachers really wanted us there to help. The principal would come and say hello and whatever. And the kids really, really appreciated us spending time with them and whatever. And I'd say, if I look at the class, we're teaching about 60 kids a week, and I'd say a third of the kids in that room, because you call on them, you get discussions going. I'd say a third of the kids in that room, if they were kids of one of us with our privileges, they would be superstars in this country. About a third of them will be good citizens. A third of them, you just don't know, you know. But it's been a very positive experience for me, because this was not an upscale neighborhood. This was, as Merrick, as you said, was pretty low-income area.
And so you've had a great blend of, I think, balances in your life. What if some of the things that now tug most on your heart in retirement and looking out over the nation and over the world?
Well, personally, I don't really have any things that tug at my heart. I just try to be a good dad, a good husband, and have a lot of friends and enjoy life. And I think that's really important. As a country matter, you worry about all the things that we are aware of today. I think the most important one is what's going on short term, what's going on with Russia and Ukraine, because that could have really dire consequences if it didn't turn out right. And what's going to evolve with our relationship with China. It gets very complicated and strategic, but really important to figure that out right. And then in the United States, we got a lot of problems that we got to try to deal with. We can do it. I'm an optimist, and I think that we'll have a leader that will come along at some point and pull the country back together, because there's no question we are still the greatest country in the world. There's no question, even when you compare us with all the success that China has had, we have so much more going for us to enable success when you take, a 10-year view than I think they do right now. And I just had lunch today with this Chinese lady from Shanghai who's like 30 years old, and she really knows both sides well, and she would totally agree with that.
Wow. Wow.
So one thing, our show is called The Calling, and the reason we call it The Calling is because we try to discover what it is that makes people do the things that they do and how they're attracted to it and how they find it. And so a lot of people probably wouldn't think of banking as being the kind of thing that you're called to do, or it's not typically, but nevertheless, I think in your case, maybe it is. How did you know that that's what you wanted to do, and what advice would you give to somebody else who on how to find their calling?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I figured out my calling was banking. It was like I needed to find a job, and I looked around, and that was the best option I had. So it turns out when I got into it, as I said earlier, I really liked it. But also, once you become a more senior person in an organization, especially J.P. Morgan, you can do a lot of good for a lot of people. And I got involved in a whole lot of things that were philanthropic and helping people. And I think, you know, that turned out to be my calling. But then beyond that, when it gets on a more personal scale, I think you want to – I've always been a great believer, as I said earlier. I think human beings need to figure out how they can be happy, whatever that is. And spirituality is part of that to me. You know, family is a critical part of that, and friends a critical part of that, having interest a critical part of that. But you got to figure out something, helping people is a critical part of that. You got to figure out some combination that's going to make you a happy person, because you're not a happy person, you're not going to be of any good to your family, your wife, or your, certainly the job. So I just encourage people to find something that they enjoy doing and pursue that. And if you're lucky, which I was lucky. I mean, I had no idea what I was going to do.
So if you talk to a young person today, and I remember when I was a print journalist, and I asked someone for advice in that career field, if you were in my shoes today, what would you do? He said to me, I would go into television. You'll make a lot more money. You'll starve as a print journalist, but go into television. What advice would you give a young person in terms of a field of calling today that, you know, if they're inclined toward it, you think is a place of great?
I would start before that, Merrick. And my advice to kids, and I talk to them a lot, is take advantage, even if you're in the ninth grade or whatever, whatever grade you're, wherever you are, take advantage of the people around you and start asking questions about what do they do? What makes them happy? You got spiritual, whatever you want to talk about, but start engaging people. And if you do that, it's going to help you start forming a view as to maybe this is what I might want to do or not want to do. And then you pursue one of them. If it doesn't work out, especially in today's environment, you don't have to stay with the same company for 40 years. If it doesn't work out after 2 or 3 years, go find something that does. But keep looking for something that you're going to be successful in, defined as being happy with what you're doing every day and sort of having some passion. Now, you can't be so passionate about everything, but you got to have at least some likability and hopefully passion for most important things in life.
So I want to kind of close by focusing on spirituality. I know that's really near and dear to your heart. You're in church every Sunday. You're in town. You're in church in Florida every Sunday. What does spirituality mean to you? And do you think that we face a spiritual crisis or a spiritual opportunity in our country?
Well, I think on the latter part of that question, we definitely are in a spirituality decline. I think the country's been through that before in different periods. And I noticed that especially with the younger generation. And even my daughters, I talk about this a little bit. And I said, look, you don't have to become a devoted Christian tomorrow or ever, if that's your decision. But at least be on what I call a spiritual journey. Start examining stuff. Why are we here in the world? How did this happen? What's the universe out there? Who's out there? And you start thinking about things like this is the beginning of a spiritual journey to me, and it only gets more interesting, exciting the more you explore it. So I'm still exploring. I'm still on my spiritual journey, and I'll stay on it, I'm sure, and hope. But I just think it's really important to have an engagement on spirituality.
So final question, and I just love having parishioners who are as bright, successful, sophisticated, you know, just wise as you are. And you've done so much strategic thinking, what advice would you offer the church, this church in particular, the church at large, about, let's say, growth, market share, meeting people's needs, leading and inspiring them going forward? If you were quarterbacking this, what would you?
Well, it gets back to what I was saying earlier about leadership. I think any organization has got to have good leadership. Good leadership starts with who's in charge. And Merrick, you're in charge here. You come in, you've energized Christ Church in a very significant way. And you've gotten some smart people around you to help build a strategy. And I talked a lot about the importance of strategy earlier. So to me, the way you start on this is exactly what we've done here and you've done, is you have a good leader and you develop strategy and you start executing it. And what does that mean? It means you're doing a lot of different things based on how you see that strategy coming together. And you've certainly touched a lot of different points of interest for the parishioners to get involved. And, you know, it's just a question of keeping them engaged, and that seems to be happening. If you look at Ann and I were in church last Sunday, and it was a pretty full church, and that wasn't the case 5 or 6 years ago. So I think we're doing a lot of great things.
This has been a joy. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate your wisdom and your sharing your time and about your life's journey. It's been great to talk to you.
Great to be here, Merrick. Thank you very much.